This is November 23rd, 2008, and we're starting our fifth session with Bob Carr, who lives in Bombay, or Mumbai. And we're continuing the theme of the fascism of thought, and we're trying to work through that to see if something new can be communicated. Highly doubtful. And we're going to have Bob leave San Francisco in April 1966 with his money willed to him from the old Seattle days, and on old acquaintance. And he's going to go to Switzerland to see Krishnamurti. He has last seen him in 1960. He has an opportunity to see him again, but he's going to travel through France, Germany, Lisbon, Spain, or something before he gets to Switzerland. So, Robert, where do you land first?
I landed in London in April, and it was snowing and kind of miserable. So Connie, my traveling friend on this journey, we decided to go to Amsterdam. From Amsterdam, we went to Copenhagen. Copenhagen, we went to Sweden, where I met a friend that I used to know in Portland. He married a Swedish girl and settled in Stockholm. I paid a 2 or 3 day visit with him, and it was, you know, interesting. He had a little boy then, 7 years old, and who was into the Rolling Stones. And anyway, after a few short days of chatting, having some good Swedish food with my friend Rick Dahlström was his name. Connie and I took a ferry boat from Stockholm and landed in Germany. From Germany, we took a train to Italy, Italy to Spain, and we landed in Barcelona. And while there, ran into Taylor Mead, one of Andy Warhol's stars in his underground films.
Okay, Robert, and let me just backtrack. Wasn't it in Switzerland you turned Rick on to LSD?
Stockholm.
In Stockholm.
Not LSD, just some good pot. Good smoking stuff.
He had not had that.
No, he never had it, and it was really liberating for him. And, you know, he had very bad arthritis in his knees and fingers. And all during the time he was high, he was free of any discomfort and really quite joyful. And he really got turned on. And kind of interesting to see that all this talk about medical marijuana so forth does have some good points to it. I remember how Rick was really relieved of all the discomfort that normally he was experiencing.
Did he continue to use it?
Well, he later got divorced from his Swedish wife and ended back in California, in San Francisco. And then later on, I met Rick after some time, after living, after returning to America and after the light show and video days. I again ran into him, and he was still having problems with his arthritis and had to have some surgery and so forth. Then I lost contact after that, and although I've tried to get in contact with him, I have failed so far.
What had he done with you before you met him in Stockholm?
He was one of my good friends in Portland. We palled around together.
Did he know about your mediumship?
Not a little bit, but he was very straightforward, kind of guy. Pardon me for breaking up here. Just a second. And something caught in my throat there from the Bombay air. So anyway.
Yeah.
He wasn't really too interested in my interest in spirituality, and he was down to earth kind of guy. And although we were very good friends and had a lot of fun together, so that was that was that.
Well, when you passed through London, did you notice any of the burgeoning counterculture there, or we weren't there long enough?
Yeah, I think the film, the Blow Up.
Yes, Blow Up.
And that was kind of a shock to the cinema world, introducing The Who.
No, The Yardbirds, yeah, I think.
Yeah, was it The Yardbirds? I thought it was. Well, anyway. There was an area of London that had all the new mod clothes. And you saw people with dyed red hair walking around and being outrageous and so forth. But I didn't have any contact with anybody there. I just did the usual things one does in London, visit the London, Museum and the Tower of London and so forth.
Yeah.
Tried to find a decent meal, which ended up going to have curry, because that was the only food that was in it. That was good. And I was a little bit used to curry. And so, but then after leaving Rick and taking a boat to Germany and spending a few days in Germany, took a train to Spain and met up with Taylor Mead. And he suggested
did you know Taylor Mead from before?
No, I didn't know him except I did a soundtrack for a film of Andy Warhol's. The film was called Blowjob, and it was with Joe D'Alessandro. It was silent.
Yep.
Just so the fellow that was there showing the films at the Presidio Theater suggested that I create a soundtrack for it. So I remember listening to a tape that Sandy Jacobs had of Taylor Mead just rambling on and talking endlessly for over an hour. So I asked Sandy if I could borrow the tape. I told him what I wanted to do, and he said, sure. So I wedded the tape to the film, and it worked perfect. It was just perfect. Taylor Mead camping around and making all these outrageous statements, and it really made the film much more interesting. So I didn't know Taylor except through the listening to him on the audio tapes that Sandy had. But when I saw Taylor, I recognized him and told him who I was, and he thought it was all very wonderful and outrageous. And we met for dinner that night, Connie Taylor and I, and a couple from New York that he knew, that he just knew from New York. They had gotten married and having their honeymoon in Spain. So he suggested that we go accompany him to Mallorca and Ibiza, two islands off the Spanish coast. And I said, sure, why not? So we got a ticket on a tourist boat that went to Mallorca, and we stayed with Mallorca for a few days, found it very boring, and not much happening.
What did Taylor do?
Well, nothing much. Robert Frost, he knew, and he gave us the keys to his house he had on a...
Oh, you don't mean Robert Frost. Side. You mean Robert Graves.
Yeah. Graves, right. And yeah. So we stayed there, but it was just boring, nothing to do. So we decided to go to Ibiza, the island. And there, something was going on. Connie and I got a pension up in the old city, up near a Roman wall that had been built, 2,000 years ago or about.
Christ, 2,000 years ago.
Yeah. And but definitely there were scores of all kinds of young people sitting in the coffee houses and outside chatting, yakking away. And definitely there was something in the air, as Bob Dylan's song, something in the air is happening.
I had a friend.
So we
had
I
had a friend who was at Ibiza at that period, 66, 67. He described it was a great place. And I think Clifford Irving, who did the Howard Hughes hoax, was hanging out there around the time. I don't know if you ever
I didn't meet him. But one day, Connie and I were sitting out having... No,
did Taylor Mead come?
Yeah, then after a short few days, he decided to go to Venice. And so he took a some kind of a Spanish, small, very small boat. And he said they were pirates, but of course that was Taylor's fantasy.
Yeah.
But
so you're sitting in the coffee house. And,
yeah. And this guy came along, young kid, 18, 19 years old, long hair. Reminded me of the San Francisco guys. We made eye contact, and he smiled, we smiled. He sat down with us. He had a knapsack and took it off, put it on. And he introduced himself as Douglas Rostone, pardon me.
Yeah.
And he had just come from Morocco, and he had come across on a tramp steamer, landed in Casablanca, and after a few days or so, he went to the coastal town. What's the name of the little town there? Where all the hippies,
Tangiers,
live.
Tangier,
right. And had an interesting experience there. Got some keef, as it's called there.
Yeah.
Smuggled it across with him to Spain, which was very dangerous to do. But so anyway, we became friends and got to know Douglas. And as we were talking, he noticed that our lingo was sort of Krishnamurti-like. And he asked us if we knew of Krishnamurti. We said, yeah. And how do you know about him? And he said, well, coming over on the boat, there was a fellow who had a book there of Krishnamurti, and he was reading it. And he said he was quite taken back by it. So we said to Douglas, well, if you're really interested in this kind of thing, he's talking in Sanand in June, and you should plan to go there. We're going to go there, and if you're there, we can meet up and get continue our conversations and so forth. So after we saw Douglas any number of times in Spain. We even went to Formentera with him, to another little island where he had a hut that he had been staying in. And he decided to give up his hut and come back to Ibiza. So I think Connie and I spent about a month there and really enjoyed our visit.
Got you mean in Ibiza? In Ibiza? You spent the month?
Yeah. About a month, yeah. And got to know some nice people there.
I have a question here. You say, did Douglas, the boat where he encountered Krishnamurti was the boat from Tangiers?
America to Casablanca.
America to Casablanca. This is before jet travel was really common, I guess.
Yeah. Well, people were still taking tramp steamers.
Right.
It was kind of the thing to do, And probably it was cheap. And Douglas is known for his interest in cheap things, accommodations and so forth. He was 18 years old.
And just to project forward, we have mentioned him. He's the guy who becomes very wealthy in Silicon Valley and then becomes arrogant with his wealth. But that's 20 years later.
Yeah.
20 years later. So I wanted to ask, you actually stayed in Robert Graves' home?
Yeah.
Well, he must have had a very interesting library.
Perhaps. I don't know. I was more interested in walking around outside and exploring the... There wasn't much of a beach. A lot of rocks. Rocky coastline there. So.
And Taylor was a friend of Robert Graves. That's how he got the key?
Yeah, that's how he knew. Yeah.
Because Robert Graves is the original hippie.
Yeah. So there was some connection there.
No, Robert Graves starts in London, I remember he did an interview in Playboy about 1971. It's a very interesting interview. And he had been a, you know, top literary intellectual in London, but he dropped out and went to Mallorca and was there. Yeah. And he went into Aquarian themes, you know, Gnosticism and the occult. That's what he was expertise in. The White Goddess, and I think that's the name of his book. And he was very influential by the 70s in the counterculture in San Francisco. And it's just interesting that you actually was in his place. You probably didn't know who he was, really.
No, I really didn't know. I just knew the name, you know.
Yeah.
So after a month of living in Ibiza and enjoying the Spanish culture, food, and friendships and everything that we made, Connie and I decided that we would fly back to Barcelona and take a train to France to a small town to meet a friend from San Francisco who was going to be there. So we rang him up and called him, and he said, yeah, come. And the little town was Mamon in southern France. So we made the journey. And friend's name was Pierre Leon, was his name. And his father was a wine merchant. They had they lived in an old stone house that was, oh God, I don't know, 300 or 400 years old. Had a beautiful garden and fresh herbs and vegetables. And his mother was a great cook. So we had wonderful French food and drank good French wine, smoked some dope with Pierre, and gained about 5 kilos.
Yeah.
Decided it was time to go, and decided to go to visit with a friend of Pierre's family, who had a house in a southern town. Well, let's see. My brain went dead today. Biarritz. Got it? Biarritz?
Yeah.
It's a vacation land. And a friend gave Pierre the keys to a house right on the beach. So we stayed there in Biarritz. And after, you know, nothing to do there in Biarritz. It's just a gambler's paradise. Everybody cruises around and promenades on the walkways, and we had a good time there. And then we decided to go to Spain, Connie and I, and we bought a car, a little English Ford.
You're going back to Spain. You're going to go back to Spain.
Yeah, because Connie's sister Vivian and her friend Elizabeth were going to be there, and we would meet up with them in Madrid. So we said goodbye to Pierre, said that he was going to go to Casablanca because he used to live there, and then he would see us back in San Francisco. So we said, okay, been nice, enjoyable, blah, blah, blah. We'll see you later. So Connie and I drove to Spain. And first we went to some small towns here and there, you know, through the Basque country. Beautiful drive to, eventually we ended in Madrid. And we got in touch with Vivian. Tell me, one of those freak accidents, we ran into her on the street. Very strange.
But you knew she was there.
Yeah, we knew she was there.
But you had no way to find her.
No. She was staying very close by to the pension that we were staying at. One of the strange things. So anyway, we enjoyed hanging out with Vivian and Liz and went to the museums, and they had Spanish food and so forth. Then Connie and I decided to head to Morocco, and so we said goodbye to Vivian, and we drove on down to the southern part of Valencia area, Spain, and went to Seville. Now, here's another strange experience happened in Seville. We were staying in a little pension there, and one night, Connie and I were out, about 1:30 in the morning. The Spaniards stay up very late, so we were getting into the habit. And we were sitting there on the sidewalk cafe having a beer, probably, and having some cerveza that was served freely with if you drank beer. And we were sitting there and looking down the street. We saw a figure coming, one that we couldn't have any mistakes about. It was the figure of our friend Leopold Fischer, alias Swami Agyananda.
Wow. And
as he came closer, we got up and ran to him, and he said, "Oh, it's incredible, you know, how we meet, you know." Couldn't get over it. So we couldn't either. So he'd just gotten back from, he'd been in Africa, and he said he was staying with some tribe of people in the inner lands there. And he said it was most amazing people, he said. And so we chatted for 2 or 3 hours and recalled all our encounters and experiences. Oh, the first thing he said to us, he said, "Are we on LSD?" I said, "No." He couldn't get over it.
Yeah.
But so anyway, we left him. He said he was headed back to, he'd gotten a post at Syracuse University in the anthropology department, and he was heading the department, so he was going back. So we said,
right.
Speaking
of LSD, was it Vivian who was with you the first time you had LSD?
Yeah.
Right. And she's your sister.
And so she's Connie's sister. Connie's sister.
Oh, and it was Lisa at the first LSD trip?
Elizabeth? Lizzie? Yeah.
She was too?
Yeah, the four of us.
And Mark, or there was a guy.
There was a guy there. Yeah, he was just a friend, kind of casual friend. He'd been interested in spiritualism and going to see a medium, and I was trying my level best to break that up, to point out that the whole thing was a shim-sham, you know.
Right, but the thing is, you're talking about the first LSD experience, early 57, with Lisa, Vivian, you and Connie, and Mark. That's five people if Mark took acid.
Right.
Okay. And then here's, you haven't seen Agyananda in, however you say his name.
Agyananda.
You haven't seen him since like 1960. This is 6 years later.
Right.
And you weren't corresponding with him in that period.
No. Just by chance.
You know, what's interesting is the aura of this spring and summer in Europe is the peak. That was the neat place, the cool thing to do in that period. A lot of Americans and Europeans were mingling in Europe. It was this gypsy life going on that was parallel to what was starting in California. But there was a whole scene going in California, in Europe, and you touched on that, you know?
Yeah. Just before I left for Europe, Connie and I stayed a few days with a friend. He was a jazz drummer, Lee Charlton was his name, and his wife. He was married to an English lady at that time. And we took some LSD, and incidentally, we took that blue LSD that we talked about the other day that was in liquid form, the earlier version. And I had listened to Bob Dylan because Wes Wilson, my friend, was really interested in Dylan. Thought he was great. And I had his albums, you know, his new albums. But he played one of Dylan's albums that night. And the song that hit me was Mr. Tambourine Man.
Yeah.
And I went completely out. Into some really far, far out realization on Mr. Tambourine Man. And when I was in Ibiza, that song just went through my mind 1,000 times, you know, that this is what was happening, that this was the keynote, kind of. I had some strong identity with the lyrics of that song.
But that acid trip was in San Francisco.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was in San Rafael, California, across the bridge in Marin County. Lee lived there.
You're down in Seville, you meet the Swami, and then what happens?
Right. Well, then we went on down to Seville, past Seville, on down to the border where you cross, Algeciras.
Yeah.
And we took a ferry boat with our car and into Tangiers.
Yeah.
I have to make a correction here. Pierre did not leave us. He was still with us. We went to Tangiers with Pierre. It was later, after we were finished with Morocco, that we split, and he went. He stayed in Morocco there in Casablanca. We dropped him off there. So we stayed a few nights in Tangier, and it was there that Connie and I went to a Cafe Central, and I had the address of a Moroccan connection that my friend Mitchell gave me when I was in San Francisco. Mitchell had been living in Tangiers, and when he came back to San Francisco, he gave me the address of one Moroccan fellow, said if I want to contact, then I should get in touch with him. So, and I asked him how to do it. He said, just go to the Cafe Central and ask where he is, and someone will take you to him. So we did. And a little Moroccan kid came up, and we gave him the address, and he said that he would follow him. So we went on a little excursion into the Medina, which is the old section of the city, where the Moroccans live. And we knocked on a door of a house, and after a few minutes, the door opened a peek. A little man was there, and we told him that we knew Mitchell and Kathy, this girl Kathy, and he welcomed us into the room. And there we saw two or three foreigners sitting on the floor, very stoned, and the room had the stench of very good hashish. So our friend Mohammed was his name, I believe, he suggested we go up on the rooftop and get to know one another and have some Moroccan tea. So we went up there, and the little boy brought us some tea in little glasses after a while. And our friend lit up a pipe, and Connie and I got stoned up on top of the roof there and drank our tea and decided, it was very good stuff. We should get some. So he said that we should meet him at the Black Cat, which was a bar on the waterfront in Tangier, at a certain time, 8 o'clock, something like that. So we said, okay, fine, bring us some. And we agreed upon a price, and et cetera, and how much weight, I can't remember, something like the size of a good-sized Hershey bar. Anyway, we eventually found our way back out of the maze of streets from the Medina, and later that evening went to the Black Cat and sat there waiting, and after a while, Mr. Muhammad arrived with a shopping bag and gave us a parcel from it, and we gave him the exchange. I think it was about the equivalent of $20, something like that, which was probably a windfall for him, but very cheap for us.
Yeah.
So from then on, we had a stash of Moroccan hashish. And
is it legal in Morocco?
No.
Wasn't legal.
But people didn't seem to care, you know.
Yeah.
He also gave us some marjam, which is a jam, kind of a sweet jam, sweet. Mm-hmm. He called it marjam. Other people have described marjam as a candy, kind of. But it was fully, you know, cut with the hashish. And he said to have it in the morning on your toast, you know. So I remember trying it, and I got so stoned I had to go back to bed, so lie down. I couldn't navigate. So.
Now, I remember reading your book, there was a slight atmosphere of paranoia at the Black Cat. What about that?
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit, because, you know, buying this grass, or buying the hash, and it was illegal, we knew that, you know. So, anyway, the three of us decided to go go on down further and head towards the Atlas Mountains to the principal city that the tourists were going to, Marrakesh. And then, of course, that was, I guess it's on Marrakesh Express. No, maybe that was later.
Yeah, didn't Joni Mitchell do a song?
Yeah.
Anyway, a lot of people. Now, you're still with Pierre. That's what you mean by the three of you. Yeah.
Yeah. And we explored Marrakesh and got stoned and enjoyed eating out. Very good French cuisine there. Good wine. We really enjoyed ourselves. And then after a time, we met a policeman and a teacher. They had married sisters, and we met them at the Medina at a big, huge nightly affair event there, where there must be about 5 acres of plaza there that's just full of all kinds of people selling everything, and magicians and snake charmers and everything you can imagine is going on. Well, we met a couple of Moroccan guys there, and with their wives who were dressed in the burqas, and they invited us to their home to meet because we were foreigners, you know. So we went there, and I remember as soon as we got there, the girls took off their burqas and they had the latest fashionable dresses on and hairdos. Uh-huh. And the guys, anyway, were married to sisters. One was a policeman and one was a teacher. So we didn't tell them about or suggest that we get stoned or anything.
Yeah.
But they invited us back the next evening for dinner, and we had a traditional Moroccan meal, which is served in a very large platter, tray. And everybody eats from a common dish, you know. So for... Anyway, it was my first encounter with a different culture other than Mexico, you know, which was really quite different. But eventually, Connie and I, we dropped Pierre off at in Morocco, and he said he'd see us later in San Francisco, which, incidentally, he never did. We never, ever got in contact with Pierre again. Tried to, but just... Didn't make the contact.
Did you know him in San Francisco?
Yeah, he was he knew Connie because Connie and he worked in a wine shop together at a department store. One of Connie's jobs he had, worked and got to know Pierre. Pierre was very outrageous, very frank, and when we were commissioned to make a film. We had Pierre act in it. He was the principal actor, and it was the same fellow that I was working for, doing films for the Midnight Theater at the Presidio Theater. Les Natalie was his name. Commissioned us to make a film, and so we made an underground film, and it was a spoof on one of Kenneth Anger's films.
Yeah.
And we made that film anyway. It was the first, you know, our film that I made, you know. And Ben Van Meter helped us, and Bill Duncan. Ben gave us a lot of tips and shortcuts, and actually loaned us one of his cameras. So we had a Bolex camera, and so we had two cameras shoot, and Pierre was a star, and we just made the film up as we went along in true underground fashion. And it was a takeoff on the Kenneth Anger's film Scorpio Rising.
Right. Now, did you know Kenneth Anger?
No, but Les Natalie had a problem with Ken about some distribution problem. So this was kind of to get even with Ken Anger.
Right.
And it was a spoof kind of on it. Not vicious or anything. But it was, anyway. So
now, when you think back at the atmosphere of the mid-60s there, it must have seemed pretty idyllic, and you could see, compared to today, why young people were in the 90s nostalgic for that period.
Yeah, you could, it had a, you know, you could just do whatever you wanted to do, you know. There were no holes barred. You know, at that time, the porno films had started. Were starting,
yeah.
And so the film companies that were processing film, the film processors, didn't care what you brought them. They just processed it. Before there was all this, oh, you can't show an ass or tits, you know.
Yeah.
But that time, whatever you wanted, they did. So there was a free carte blanche, you know, and that opened so many doors that helped get the hippie thing going, you know. It was kind of freedom that was, people were just sick and tired of the police and the status quo, and the whole gay thing was exploding, the hippie thing was happening, you know. And it just was time for a change, you know. And so it was in the air, and you know, it was just, people said, enough is enough. You know, we're going to do what we're going to do, and just, you know, forget it. You know, we're doing it.
Yeah. Well,
so that was the attitude.
Right, and I was going to ask you, did you interface with any of the gay culture in London, Stockholm, Barcelona?
No.
It wasn't visible yet, I guess.
No, not so much. It was still in the closet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're down, where are you? You're in Casablanca.
Well, we dropped Pierre off in Casablanca, and we drove back to through Fez, which is the capital, and then, which incidentally, my friend Mitchell Chanelis, the friend who turned us on to gave us the address of Muhammad, is now living in Fez.
Right now?
Yeah, he has a little house there. And he has a Moroccan boyfriend. So, and well, we're in touch through the internet. We all got connected. It's a strange world.
You got connected after not being in touch with him for like 30 years, right?
Yeah. He found my book, and you know, so that book has God Men Common has been a real connection for people, an eye opener, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah, here we are talking about it now, 5 years after it was published, 4 years or so.
5 years, yeah.
3, yeah, whatever.
Anyway, 2003.
Yeah, so then we went back and decided that we would have to smuggle the Hershey bar back to Spain with us, or dump it, you know. So we said, oh, what the heck. Connie said, I'll break it up in little pieces and put it in my jockey shorts. So we went through the Spanish border without a problem, and made our way, a nonstop drive all the way up to Valencia, Barcelona, into France, and on into Switzerland. And when we arrived in Sonnen, we arrived at the little square there where there's a little tiny, there's a well, a fountain there of water, and there was Douglas and his backpack.
Wow.
So we said, okay, So we might as well plan to stay together. So let's get a tent. And so we went to the nearest good-sized town and bought a tent and the provisions and camp stove and all the things you need for camping out. And we made arrangements with a farmer to pay him two francs a day or something to camp on his property alongside the little river that was right next to Krishnamurti's tent where he gave the talks. It was only like a 3-minute walk to the tent. So
this is about, you said June earlier, but I think this is July in your book. It says July. And you've been traveling about 2 months.
Yeah.
Or no, 3 months. April, May, or middle
April, May, June, yeah.
Yeah, July, maybe 2.5 months, yeah.
Yeah. We're killing time for Krishnamurti. Right. And seeing
and
Europe.
But you're really, once you're insane and it's all about Krishnamurti and you're pretty anxious, nervous, excited, what is the feeling?
Yeah. Well, I remember the first day of the talk, the three of us went in the tent, and there were like, you know, maybe 1,500 people there, 1,000, somewhere like that. It was all very staged. There was a platform, and there were bleacher seats there, and we got as close as we could possibly get next to the fire, you know. And so when he came out, and then I said to my, I remember saying to myself, well, here I am. Now I have an opportunity of a lifetime. I'm going to listen to an enlightened man, and he's going to be here a whole month, and hopefully I'll be able to see him. And this was the best thing that could ever happen to me in my life, I thought. And I was really gung-ho into Krishnamurti's image.
And he was going to talk for a month?
Every other day he gave a talk. And then he gave some smaller talks in the chalet where he was staying, and I would attend some talks there. Douglas and I and Connie were staying in the tent there, and I remember after the first, third, or fourth talk, I decided to go for a walk by myself. And along the river towards Gestad, which was the real classy little town there.
Speak a little closer to the mic.
Okay, how's this? I don't want to make it puffs. Okay. Anyway, as I was walking along the river's bank there on my way towards Gestad, I saw a figure coming, and I recognized from the that it was probably an Indian, looked like an Indian by the hairstyle. Indians have the same hairstyle almost over all the time. At that time, now it's changed. Now they have everything, spiked hair. Anyway, as he got closer, I saw he was a very handsome, good-looking Indian. And as we came into contact with our eyes, I smiled and he smiled, and I don't know who spoke first, but one of us spoke and said hello, and I remember he said, what are you here for, why are you here, or something. I said, listening to Krishnamurti, you too? He said, oh no, I'm just happen to live here, he said. But so we sat down on a bench. The Swiss put little benches everywhere. People love to walk, and they have little benches to sit by. So we sat there by the river, and we probably sat there for the better part of 30 or 40 minutes. And during that time, he said his name was U.G. Krishnamurti. He had the same name as the old man, but they weren't connected in any way. But he did allude that he had listened to him and knew of him for some time. So I said, well, he told me he lived in a chalet there called Sunbeam. No, not Sunbeam, pardon me. They had another name. I'll come up with it in a minute. It's a very tricky name. And with a Swiss lady named Valentine. I didn't know too much about. I didn't ask any questions. But I said, well, we're living in a tent, a blue tent by the river, and drop by when you want to and bring Valentine if you like. Well, the very next evening, Yuji came by with Valentine, and we introduced ourselves, Douglas and Connie, and we got to know Yuji quite well, and from then on, I think we saw him every day for some time.
He would come to visit you?
Either we would visit him in a coffee shop or at his chalet where he was staying with Valentine. Tiffany, it was called. Tiffany.
And what was the name?
Oh, it's Tiffany. I can't spell it. It's in the book. Anyway,
what was Valentine like?
Well, she was a very strange, hard to get to know, older woman, perhaps 15 years older than Yuji, and very kind of silent. She spoke in kind of a strange voice, and I had a hard time making any contact with her. Yuji was very simple and very open and very friendly and very warm-hearted. And during that time, Yuji spoke a lot about J.K. and his encounters with him in India, about his early life, his search, his staying in Rishikesh in the mountains, in Haridwar, there under the guidance of a Swami Shivananda, who incidentally I had read some of his books in America, but I found them uninteresting and very traditional, so I just kind of passed them on. I didn't. It was very traditional, but Yuji said that he had found that the Swami was eating lime pickle, and so he said, and after that he dismissed him and said that he was anyone eating lime pickle couldn't be in the state they said they were in. To this day, I don't know what he means, except he was enjoying, one of the Indian condiments, So anyway, Yuji had a lot of hot and cold feelings about J.K. In one sentence, he would praise him, and the next, he would tear him apart. And I was very open to listen to it, but very protective of J.K. because I had 20 years of interest there at stake. Yeah, I've been reading J.K. and was fully indoctrinated in J.K.'s system of thinking. I had become, a miniature J.K., in my own viewpoint. So listening to Yuji tear him apart was... I was open to listen to his argument, but I think I came up with a feeling that he was envious of J.K.
Yeah, there was something wrong with Yuji. You probably felt Yuji missed something.
Well, Yuji, I felt, Connie said, I think Yuji has a problem with J.K. And Yuji said, no, I have no problem with him. And Connie said, no, I think you do. And it was evident that there was a problem there. So,
what's amazing, let me just say this, Robert, what's amazing is that you bump into this guy, and he turns out to be the key co-thinker of Krishnamurti. I mean, you're really lucky to bump into this guy. Yeah. And you must have been amazed. He said, oh, yeah, when you first meet him, I know about Krishnamurti. Yeah, I listened to a few talks. Now, a few days later, you're hearing that the guy knows everything about Krishnamurti and it's got a bone to pick. And you must have been amazed at that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just the world. I was utterly, sold on the fact that we are connected.
that
all
you are,
life is connected. Everything. Yeah. You and I are connected.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. I've been waiting here for 40 years to wrap it up with you.
So Douglas, of course, when Douglas tells the story, it was Douglas who met Eugene first and introduced him, and that's his version. So everybody has a version. So, you know.
Well, had he met Eugene independently of you?
I don't believe so. I think later on he used to see him with us. He always was with us all the time, except when Eugene engineered a situation where Douglas wasn't present. Eugene loved to go for rides in the car, and the car was a little car. It only held four people comfortably. So it was Connie, Eugene, Valentine, and myself sometimes. And Douglas, it was too difficult to fit three or a fifth person into the car. You could do it, but it was squashed.
You said Douglas didn't get to go? Is that what you just said?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. But the incredible thing is that, you know, this is 42 years ago when you meet him. And when you think, it's amazing to think, it's not that long ago, but the change, that you meet this guy in a castle, and you never would think that 40 years later people are downloading him. I mean, that's science fiction, right?
Yeah.
Downloading him and have tapes of him and all that. Isn't it amazing how it changes from what you were experiencing?
Well, I can say, I'm not trying to create some sort of I don't know, whatever you might want to call it. I think meeting Eugene was the most important event in my life.
Right, and that's July 66.
Yeah.
And, you know, now let's look at what was going on in July 66. Let's see. Frank Zappa's Freak Out was coming out in July. I was in Los Angeles. I was in Los Angeles in July, the end of July 66, and Dylan had his accident on July 29th, 66, his motorbike accident.
Oh, really?
And Dave Worster is withdrawing from Ralph Doobie, maybe already withdrawn from him. Doobie's going to Hawaii. There's a lot going on in the summer of 66. McLuhan is starting to surface in the media. Christian Murty is going to do all those amazing talks in the fall in Ojai that were very important to David Worster. Leary's probably busted and running around in Texas or something at that point. And the Beatles are doing their last tour, I think, in the summer of 66. They're getting sick of touring and meeting mayors of cities in the Philippines and things like that, as reported by John Lennon later. Politics, what's going on? The Vietnam thing is really heating up.
Yeah.
The anti-Vietnam movement. I don't know, it was probably other things. And it was also a great summer for music. That was the Love and Spoonful. There was great music that summer. Dylan's stuff was out. And so
you were...
Yeah, and according to Dave Worster, you know, Rai was beginning to return to essence in 6 months. So you got the Rai thing happening in January 67.
I don't know about that. So.
Yeah, I know. It's a thought. It's a violent thought.
Anyway, what happened with Yuji was that he had a book that he'd been writing, sometimes he said Valentine was writing it, but I think he was writing it. And in the book, there was a part that talked about a reading that his grandfather got when he was a young, maybe 14 or 15 years old, somewhere around then, in Madras, from a Nadi reader, an astrological reader, who reads palm leaves that are supposed to have been written 400 or 500 years ago by some former Nadis who had some sort of a computerized version of what's going to happen in the future to everybody on Earth. Anyway, Yuji dragged out the reading that he had and read it to us, and I read it. It was typed out on a 8.5 by 11 sheet of white paper. And in it said, that Yuji was born with the name of his future guru, and that he would meet him, and after some time attain moksha.
Yeah, himself. Let me read, Robert, let me read from your book. You quoted it, it's probably pretty accurate. It's on page 109. The reading, it says, Yuji began to read from the paper, which began by giving the planetary positions of his time and birth, which was about 1918, I think. I could look it up in the Wikipedia. July 1918, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that Yuji's birth, approximately?
Yeah.
It says, quote, he and Yuji is being given this, or his father is being given this when Yuji's 14.
Grandfather.
Grandfather.
Grandfather, yeah.
Is being, the grandfather is asking this guy to read the young 14-year-old boy's life. But Yuji is not there. Yuji is not there, right?
I don't know.
Okay, so it says, quote, he will attain moksha, or liberation, in this very life.
Yeah.
After intense inner struggle, but the inner crisis will end well. A great teacher who puts him on the right path will help him. In his 49th year, he will be born again. Now, that would have been 67, the next year, from your meeting in 66.
Right.
He will always, it says, he will always be on the move, never staying in one place long, and he will live to a ripe old age, preaching all the richness of his personal experience. Which, in retrospect, is totally accurate. You couldn't get more precise than that.
Yeah.